The first thing that I'd like to do is just get confirmation that you're okay with me recording this.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay.
No problem at all.
Perfect. And we'll just start with your full name, birth date, and where you were born.
William J. Rush. My birthday is April 26, 1959. I was born in Pendleton, Oregon.
Okay, great. I just wanted to start with sort of a basic chronological question. Have you always been attracted to technology? Is that something you were interested in as a child or something that sort of came?
Yeah, I liked to tinker around with electronic stuff. And then one day when I was in high school chemistry class, we had a guy come in from a semiconductor company and talk, and I thought that sounded like something that I wanted to do. So probably, and before that, like I said, just playing around with electronic stuff, you know, go to Radio Shack and buy things and put them together and
right.
make stuff. So, yeah.
Do you remember what company he was with?
No, I don't. I do not know.
Right. And so why did you choose Oregon State for your undergraduate? Did they have a good reputation for electrical engineering at that time?
Yes, Oregon State was a good school. Actually, I went my first year to a private school in Indiana.
Oh.
So my freshman year I spent at a college called Rose-Hulman Institute of Technology. And it was what I thought was one of the best schools for undergraduates. It was really focused on undergraduate teaching, and they had a engineering-specific curriculum. And it was hard to get into that school, but I did. And I went there, and it was a great school, but it was very expensive. And it was also an all-male school. And so I went there, I did work study, and, you know, I saved all my life, and all my savings was gone in the first year. And so I kind of had to make a decision about what I was going to do. I could have continued there, but I didn't really particularly like living in Indiana. So I decided to come back to Oregon, and I had a Oregon State scholarship that I could come here and go for really cheap, and so I did, and then I became a resident assistant, so I got room and board paid for my junior and senior years, and I was able to work during the summer and make enough money to pay for tuition and books, and so I came out okay, and I didn't really have to take out any loans or anything. So I blew all my money the first year, and then ended up at OSU anyway, and so that was, it was okay. I mean, I didn't change majors or anything. It just turned out that it worked out really good for me, but I split my education that way.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any teachers at Oregon State that were particularly inspiring, acted as a mentor?
Not so much, really. I mean, it may sound strange, but not, you know, I just, because I didn't spend my first year there, I didn't feel like I really got to know teachers like I would have if I would have been my freshman year. So I pretty much just kept my head down and focused on my education. And I didn't really get involved that much, as much as I should have, with the different professors and stuff like that there. Of course, the classes were much bigger.
Yeah.
You know, you were taught a lot by TAs and graduate students and things like that. So, of course, the professors were available, but I just really didn't do that much with them. My loss.
So how did it come about that you got your job at Tektronix? Were you recruited, or did you apply?
Well, that's the good thing about semiconductor, at least back in the early 80s, was a really good time for semiconductors. And so that was kind of the allure that I saw, you know, from the guy who came to the high school chemistry class was, you know, it was a really booming type of a industry. You could get jobs, you know, with companies like Intel and National Semiconductor, and, you know, and so it turns out that the recruiting program at OSU is really good. So most of the graduates in electrical engineering pretty much had their choice. You know, you could pick, like, maybe the top five places you would want to go, and they would recruit you and, you know, fly you around the country, and you could go visit the places and get an experience. And so I did that. You know, I didn't want to work in Silicon Valley. I knew that that wasn't for me because I was from Pendleton. I didn't really want to go there. But I did go down there and interview for a couple of jobs. And where I really wanted to go was to Micron, or another small company called AMI that's in Pocatello, Idaho, because it was close to Pendleton. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, you know, it's going to be a smaller town atmosphere, and maybe that would be a place where I wanted to go. But it turned out that after interviewing with them, and I interviewed with AMD, and I forget some other, I didn't interview with Intel, but I interviewed with about three companies in the Bay Area, and then I went and interviewed at HP in Corvallis, mm-hmm. and Tektronix. And so it came down to HP and Tektronix, because those seemed to be more what I was after. And I thought I wanted the HP job, and it was actually more money, but I liked the Tektronix job for what I would be doing. Because the HP job seemed like there was a lot more training, and you didn't get to do stuff for a few years. You know, they kind of like put you through this new graduate mill to get you to be what they wanted, and then you would start working on parts after a few years. And if I went to Tektronix, I felt like I could have a bigger impact sooner. And so I picked them. I picked them instead, and never regretted it.
Had you heard of Tektronix before that, or?
Yes.
So their reputation preceded them.
Yeah,
in industry.
Everybody knew about Tektronix, and I'd actually picked up brochures on Tektronix when I was in Indiana in my freshman year, because they recruited at that school pretty heavily, and so I knew that that was a company that I was going to look into. But I thought I wanted to be more in semiconductors. And, of course, Tech did build semiconductors, but I didn't know that. So my job wasn't building semiconductors. My first job with Tech was evaluating semiconductors that they bought from other companies. Mm. And so it was a very fun job that I really liked.
Why is it that you wanted to work with semiconductors specifically? Was it just a preference?
It's just really techy stuff.
Okay.
And that's part of the nice thing about OSU. I think nowadays most colleges that offer electrical engineering have some type of fabrication. Mm-hmm. But at that time, not many did, but OSU did. So even as an undergraduate, we actually got to do what we saw here. They had a fab. You could take wafers, you could deposit metal on them, you could build things out of them and do that kind of thing. You could design circuits and stuff. And so that was, you know, once I'd done that, I knew that that was kind of the thing that I wanted to do, or be around at least that kind of technology.
And your first job at Tektronix was evaluating semiconductors that they had purchased, so they didn't do the fabrication.
That's right.
At Tektronix.
So yeah, in their instrumentation, of course, they would build some of their own components, but they'd also buy them, especially like microprocessors, memories, you know, those kind of things that they used a lot of, and so they needed to make sure that they would work and that they were reliable. And so that was my job, was to really assess the reliability of different types of components. And at that time, the components, the outward appearance of components were changing. They used to make components that looked like little caterpillars that had little leads that you would stick into holes in circuit boards and solder them. And at that time, in the early 80s, they were going to what they call surface mount, which is everything now. And so they didn't know if those were going to be good for their instrumentation or not. So we did all kinds of different evaluations. We would beat them up and bake them and spray water on them and all different kinds of things just to make sure that they would really work well for the instruments, because that's what Tech did. They built instruments that were very expensive that people used to measure circuits and things like that. So they had to be a little bit better than what people were going to use them to measure. So we basically called them Cadillacs. Everything they built was a Cadillac, and so we had to make sure that it was going to be good. And so that was my job. And so I had a lot of fun at that.
And just sort of a basic question, what was your typical work day like? Were you like the people we saw downstairs, surrounded by the big machinery?
No, not so much. Not really at all. Because it was more engineering. So my interfaces were with people who were designing instruments and with the people who were supplying the parts. And so that was the fun thing for me about working in reliability, is it was never the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, every day was different. I mean, we would have some tests that we would do that would take long times, like sometimes 3 months. You know, the test would, we'd be torturing parts for that long, but we could always be working on something else in the meantime. And then if the parts broke, we would also try to figure out why and what happened and what was wrong. Now, a lot of times we would use the supplier and we'd send them the bad parts and say this broke, but sometimes we would try to figure it out ourselves too. And so was constantly doing that, and we also interfaced with what they was their purchasing people, so the people that actually bought the parts. And so we would make a approved supplier list, and so we'd be involved with the specifications and things like that as far as purchasing. So it really got a lot of interface with different people, and like I said, this surface mount thing was new, and so all the engineers at Tektronix were interested in that. They were saying, well, you know, this could make our instruments smaller, but we don't want to do that if it's not going to be better, right? If it's going to make them less quality, we don't want to do it. And so it gave me a position where I got to talk with a lot of people, because they were interested in the evaluations that we were doing on those circuits. But yeah, it was nothing like production. It's just constantly different every single day.
How many people were at Tektronix, just roughly? Was it about this size?
No, much bigger, bigger. Much bigger. I don't know exactly, but I believe that the peak was the year I started was 81. Mm-hmm. And I think that was right around their peak in people. And now that you mention it, I can't think of what. I think it was like 18,000 or so people that they had. So it was huge. It was a huge company. And that was the part I didn't like about Tektronix, was it was just a really big company. So even though I felt like I had an important job, it was hard to see how it fit in such a large company like that.
Right. And how many people were you working with on a, did you have a team of a certain?
Yeah, we had, I think there was about six of us. Mm-hmm. There was a manager, a secretary, and four engineers, about four of us.
Were there many women, just out of curiosity?
The secretary was a woman, but not a lot.
Right.
Not a lot in technology, especially back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
I think in my class at OSU, there was 400 people, I think, in EE, and I think there were 2 women.
Wow. So not many at all.
Not
then.
Many. There were women at Tektronix, though. I mean, they tried really hard to hire women, but there just wasn't that many that were interested in that kind of stuff. So there were a few around, but there weren't any in my group.
I know that Tektronix offered courses. Did you take any classes at through Tech?
I took just about any class that I could. I don't remember that many that were really Tektronix classes. I mean, they would hire people to come in and teach various things, and I took all of those that I could. So I had different classes on like statistics, management training classes, those kind of things. So just everything that I could get, I tried to take advantage of. So they were good about that, and they did offer educational reimbursement and stuff like that. But I don't remember taking Tektronix specific classes. I know that they had them, but those didn't seem like that they were applicable for what I needed, so I didn't really mm-hmm. avail myself too much to those.
Mm-hmm. What was the morale? You were kind of at the peak. You were working there at the peak of Tektronix.
Yes.
What did that feel like? How was the morale around the workplace?
Well, it was maybe not as good as you'd think, because the thing about a company when it gets large like that, at least what I think, my experience is only with them, so I don't know about other companies, but my perception is that when companies grow to a certain size, they have a hard time figuring out how to be organized. Mm-hmm. And Tektronix was a company that was constantly reorganizing. And so they had a phase that they called divisionalization, where they would try to make divisions that would run the thing. And then they would have a phase called centralization. And it seemed like it was like a 5 to 7 year cycle. So they would, in 1 year, they would be going this way, and then after a few years, they'd be going back. And it just seemed like that they were struggling with how to do that. And so at the time that I went, the divisions were really strong, and they were trying to divisionalize a lot of things. But that kind of hurt their economy of scale. So, being vertically integrated, they could do a lot of things. But as they divisionalized, then they ended up duplicating so many things. And so it was just people were having a hard time figuring out exactly what the company was trying to make of itself, because it had gotten to such a size that it just needed to do that. And so there were divisions that were doing really well and divisions that weren't doing very well. And right at that time, they were in very strong competition with Hewlett-Packard. Mm-hmm. It was really just Tektronix or Hewlett-Packard, and that's where you would buy instrumentation. And Tektronix also fooled around with computers. They had their version of a personal computer that most of the people in the company used. And but they did things a certain way, and it turned out that the way that they picked never really went commercial, and the way that HP picked did. And of course, HP still makes computers now. Tektronix never really made computers. They made computer terminals. And back in those days, computer terminals were really expensive, and they, paid a lot of money and stuff like that. So they had a huge business in that, but eventually that all went away, right? When big computers went away, then the terminal business went away. And so it was a struggle. And that was also evident in their profit sharing. That was another thing I really liked about Tech was they had profit sharing, but the years before I started there, they shared a lot of profits. But while I was there, profit sharing was almost nothing. I mean, they would have these big announcements that they would make throughout all the buildings. They have, 50 different buildings on the campus. And there'd be this one announcement, and a lady would come on and say, profit sharing for this quarter is, and she would announce what it was. But so many, all I remember is hearing 0.0%. And so I don't remember getting very much profit share while I was there. That was kind of a disappointment for a lot of people who had been there for many years, because they had years, I know, that were as high as like 20%. So 20% of their salary, in addition, a 20% addition to their salary just in profit sharing. And so it was a good thing, but while I was there, they didn't have a lot of profits, because they were doing this divisionalization thing, and they were still expanding. I mean, they built a lot of manufacturing across the river in Vancouver, and that was the latest thing. But there was also a lot of competition, from Japan and other companies, that would build cheaper instruments that people would buy just because they were cheaper, right? And so Tech was kind of had the identity, again, of making the best, but that's a small market, right? Military and people like that, they would give lots of equipment to colleges and labs. And so kids were used to using Tektronix stuff. It's kind of like Apple, right, where they would give computers to classrooms so people would be used to using them. Tech did the same thing, but it's still, it was just at the peak. And things started to slow down, and there were layoffs, and again, they were struggling with divisionalization, centralization. So a lot of that stuff was going on.
Mm-hmm. And is that why there were a lot of people spinning off to form their own?
I kind of think of it maybe as happening the other way around. I think people that were spinning off kind of created that situation. I don't think people spun off to get away from Tech. Mm. They just spun off because they had different business ideas. And then a lot of the best people were those spin-off people, right? And so the people that were left, that kind of, I think, helped with the slowdown. That was just my perception. But there was a lot of, a lot of interest in the spin-offs. People wanted to maybe get involved with those. And that was kind of my choice at the end with Tektronix. Is I got the job offer to come to TriQuint, but at the same time, one of my friends was at a different division, and they were being spun off, and he invited me to go there. So I had to make a decision. And it was a really hard decision. I almost picked the wrong one because of my friend. I wanted to go work with my friend, somebody I knew. But I had a friend here at TriQuint also. So I liked the job at TriQuint better, and so I picked that one. But the job I could have got at staying at TriQuint is in what they called the Semiconductor Test Systems, STS. Again, a division, right, that it got spun out and eventually turned into Credence. If you drove on the freeway, you might have noticed this big empty building that said Credence on it. So they built systems, and in fact, some of those systems that we saw on the test floor are Credence systems that we buy to test semiconductors. And so that sounded really interesting, but it didn't ever, it pretty much collapsed, at least in this area. I mean, that's not a really ongoing business in Washington County anymore, is semiconductor test systems. But it was big for a while.
Right.
But that just made me really glad that I came to TriQuint instead of going there.
I bet that happened with a lot of the spinoffs, that they were real big for a couple of years and then just...
a lot of spinoffs never amounted to anything, right? I mean, they just struggled and got venture capital and struggled some more and then eventually died out.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably two or three of those for every one that made it.
Right.
I'm guessing. But that was the cool thing about Tektronix is they really encouraged that. They just encouraged people to do anything that they could think of. And I think I told you on the phone that they actually had stock rooms that were like Radio Shacks, right, where they encouraged people to just go in and get components and try to put them together and make whatever it is they needed to do their job or to make their instruments better or to just investigate something that they had an idea about. And the president of the company, I would see him once in a while, Howard Vollem, he would just walk around, and especially at night, and he'd find people doing stuff, and he'd say, "What are you doing?" And he would just encourage people to keep doing it, right? And just play with ideas and things. And so Tech had a lot of those. They had a lot of things that they built in the company that never made it as products, but they experimented in a lot of different things. They made printers and copiers. They made scanning electron microscopes. They made satellite TV systems. You know, they had all these kind of things that they built one or two of and tested them out and then decided not to do it. And sometimes those would spin off,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes they would just die. So they had a lot of that going on, a lot of it. And that was one of the funner aspects of Tektronix. I think that's why there's so many spin-offs from them. It's just that was what they encouraged.
And you had a friend who had spun off to TriQuint?
Yeah, one of the four guys that was in my reliability group, he didn't like working in that group and eventually found his way to this other group at Tektronix that was building gallium arsenide devices. So it started out as a research group, I think way back like in the 70s. And so they had these guys that were just basically tinkering and playing around because, again, they had to be able to measure the best that people were building. And so it had to be that much better.
Right.
And so Tektronix thought that they needed the performance from gallium arsenide and able to do that. And so they had this research group that was playing around. And they did build some components that were used in some of their oscilloscopes and equipment and stuff, but not a lot, right? It's just they didn't sell a lot of those things because they were so expensive. But so they had that research group, and he took like a leave of absence, and before I knew it, he was working with them. And then they spun off out of the research area in Tektronix. They didn't leave the campus. They just came up with a name, and basically they were a subsidiary, a wholly owned subsidiary of Tech. And that started in 85.
And then how long after they had formed TriQuint did you join them? Was it
just months? They spun out in April and I started in October.
Did it take convincing to get you over there, or were you just really excited?
No, like I said, it was a tough decision, but just because I had two what I thought were good choices. You know, I had two friends. The one guy at the Semiconductor Test Systems was actually my boss for a time while I was working at Tech, and then the guy at TriQuint was my coworker.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and I thought both of them were excellent, and I just had to make this big list of pros and cons, you know, and I agonized for a couple of weeks just trying to figure out what to do. Because I knew I wasn't going to stay where I was. I was either going to go with one or the other of my friends. And it just seemed like being number 36 at a brand new startup was a little bit more enticing than building semiconductor test systems, which even though I liked that guy as my boss, it just didn't seem like quite an exciting type of a job. Because they would sell maybe three a year.
Oh.
You know, they'd build these big things and sell them for like $1 million, which was a lot more money back then. But that's what they did, you know. It was less than a dozen a year that they would build. Mm. And so I picked the semiconductors.
What was the name of your friend at TriQuint?
His name was Art Frazier.
Okay.
And he really liked TriQuint because he wanted to do marketing type of things.
Mm.
So even though we worked together in the reliability group at Tektronix, he didn't want to do that. He'd had enough. I don't know how long he'd been there, but he was there years before I was there, and so he'd kind of gotten tired of that, and he wanted to try something different, and he was really enticed by the marketing. Even though he was doing the marketing, he was also doing the REL, the reliability stuff, also, because it was such a small group, right?
Right.
So he had multiple hats, but he thought if he could get me to come over, then I would do the reliability part, and he could focus more on the marketing, which is what he wanted to do.
So when you first started there, you were doing reliability testing of the product?
Yes. I just basically flipped my job, right? So for 5 years at Tektronix, I was buying components from outside companies, and now I was going to be one of those companies that was trying to sell components to people who would use them. So I thought that that experience was really good. I knew what my customers were feeling and wanting.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who was running the fabrication part of TriQuint was the person who hired me. And I think I told you this already on the phone, but the main thing that they wanted to do was to just tell people that this fancy stuff is okay. It's newfangled, and, you know, there's always a lot of risk with that, but they just want to say, you know, it's okay. It has high performance, but it has reliability. And so that was my job. And that was another really plus for me because it was a management job. There was four other guys who were doing, you know, the shake, rattle, and roll, and bake, bust, and rust, or whatever you want to call it, you know, on the components. And I was going to be the manager.
Hmm.
I'd never been a manager before, so that was kind of the tipping point for me, was I could be the manager. But, of course, it's still hands-on, but it was mostly to just be the mouthpiece to tell the world that gallium arsenide is okay. And that was my job. I didn't have to say that it was better or anything, just, you know, it's just a higher performance, but the reliability and quality is just as good. And so that was my job.
How long had gallium arsenide been around? Was it just brand new as a concept, or?
Well, it had been around for quite a long time, but mostly as a novelty. And so there were a lot of laboratories that were building it, and a lot of colleges and universities that were dabbling with it. So there had been devices for quite a while, but none of them have been commercial. And so there was a lot of government interest in gallium arsenide, especially for digital things. They wanted to make computers out of it. And so did Seymour Cray. They wanted to make Cray computers. I don't know if you've heard of Cray.
Mm-hmm.
Cray was the big supercomputers that they built back in those days. And so, like, the weather predictions were all done on Cray computers. Everybody wanted a Cray computer, right? But that was a whole different era of computing where people shared a big computer. But so they just wanted to make faster, better computers. But gallium arsenide was faster, but it wasn't really, in my opinion, ever going to work for what they wanted. Because for one thing, it would run hotter. So they actually built a Cray computer out of gallium arsenide parts, but it ran in liquid.
Wow.
To keep it cool. So they couldn't just trust air. You know, they couldn't just put a fan on it. They had to put it in liquid to make sure that it didn't get too hot. So they had these computers that were in liquid just to get the speed. So they could be faster and do more computations than anything else back in those days, right? And that's the way they built computers. It's not like today, right? I mean, today a Intel microprocessor is more powerful than one of those Cray computers. But, you know, that's the nature of that business, right? Is it just, it's fleeting. But anyway, the government wanted to use these things in defense applications and stuff. So they were pumping a lot of money into gallium arsenide. And today they're pumping a lot of money into gallium nitride, which is the new fancy thing. So everybody's doing that. We're not doing that here, but we're doing that in Texas. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's the next material, right? So we get performance by changing the materials, not by shrinking like everybody else. So we just find the next best material. So instead of, we started with gallium arsenide, which was pretty good. And then after that came indium phosphide, which was better. And now it's gallium nitride that's the best. I don't know if there's anything else that could come up, but that is basically the what they call a wide band gap material. So you can make devices that run at 100 gigahertz and 100 volts. So silicon devices are, because they're shrinking, the voltage is going down. So most devices run at like a volt now. So gallium nitride runs at 100 volts. So it's can do things that silicon devices, again, can't do. So it's just, so gallium arsenide had been around, but it wasn't a commercial thing. Mm-hmm. And that's what we were trying to do at TriQuint, was we were trying to go to companies like AT&T, Nortel, all these companies that were building fiber optic systems, right? So when you put the electrical or the phone calls into a fiber, you're cramming a whole lot of channels, right? It's like 30,000 phone calls on one fiber. And they took a lot of digital power to do that, and we built those chips. And so we were trying to convince those guys that it's okay to use gallium arsenide, and that was kind of our big job. And so those were our, for 10 years our biggest customer was Nortel, which doesn't even really exist as a company today, but they're the ones that put in most of the fiber optic systems around the world. And they just put in too many. And then the business basically went away. People said, well, we got enough now. And they kind of crumbled under their own weight. The same thing happened to AT&T, right? I mean, they used to be the only phone company, and now they don't really exist anymore. Right. They just grew so big and so rich, and then they just kind of crumbled under their own wait, it happened to AT&T, to Nortel. And so now all that business is in China. Mm-hmm. Companies like called Huawei and ZTE are doing the same thing. And so we're selling parts to them. But it's just a few thousand parts a year for $100 a part kind of business. Mm-hmm. And in the 80s, that was great business for TriQuint. I mean, that was the kind of thing that kept us going.
You mentioned on the phone that the first couple years at TriQuint were kind of a challenge, and I wanted you to elaborate on what sort of challenges you faced in those first couple years.
Yeah, everything was a challenge, but mostly it was making the money, right? Because we kind of had it very easy in the first 5 years because we were a subsidiary of Tektronix. Mm-hmm. And they kind of coddled us. So we didn't necessarily have to make a profit. We got to, use their infrastructure. We, lived in their building. We were tenants of theirs. And so they kind of made life easy as a startup, right? Because we had deep pockets. but then when they decided that they really didn't want us anymore, that they wanted to make their money out of, their investment, and they weren't going to use very many of our parts. It wasn't essential for their instrumentation. So when that went away, that was kind of the struggle was, well, who's going to be our deep pockets? Where are we going to find people that want to give us money? Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the overarching problem was, for any startup company, right, is how do you find your killer application where you can make your money? And so that was, like I said, the overarching, but of course, underneath that, we had the technology itself. So gallium arsenide was okay, but it was hard. It was hard to make it. It was, everything we did was invented here, The way we processed, we invented it. The way we tested, we invented it. So it's like everything that we did, we kind of had to invent because we were doing stuff that nobody else had done before. And so everybody was challenged. I mean, from the designers to the people that developed the test to the marketing people to the sales force, everybody was kind of challenged and trying to figure out how do we make good stuff and how do we deliver and how do we find customers who are willing to give us money? So everybody was challenged. And it was small, we only had the people that we had to have. We lost all that kind of infrastructure when we moved away from Tektronix. We just had the bare essentials. So people usually had two or three jobs, kind of.
And in those early years, you were contracting with the government a lot? Were they kind of your new deep pockets?
We were, and they were good for not just TriQuint, but for the industry. There was a government program where they pumped in millions of dollars, and there was a DARPA, a program where they also gave us a lot of money, and for defense applications, gallium arsenide was an especially good material in terms of things like radiation. So when we put our devices in space, they would last much longer than silicon parts. Mm. So there's a certain type of radiation that is in space that wears out semiconductors pretty fast. But gallium arsenide, for example, is like 100 times better for that type of radiation. So they did have some really specific interests in it. And so those government deals were really good for us. But it's a whole different business model. You spend a lot of time with paperwork. I mean, you get the request for proposal, then you have to write the proposal, and then you have to get it, pass it through, and they modify it. And it's a whole lot of work for, what you're doing. And the output is, we might just build one wafer, right? So it's not getting the fab filled up, but it is getting money. Right. And so we did that because we also had a kind of a joke internally that we would do anything for a buck. And so we taught classes and we charged people because gallium arsenide was interesting. So we had people from all over the world come and take a class, and they'd spend $2,500 a week. And then if they wanted for another $5,000, we would actually fabricate a wafer of their design and give them like 20 parts so they could get that. And so that was the foundry business that I mentioned before. And so we we made that a business of just doing that, right? And so we gave it away to colleges, but we charged other people to do it. And we made a little bit of money there. We made a little bit of money from Nortel, a little bit of money from the government, and just every place we could get it, we would do it. And so we tried to, that's helped us be that diverse company, because we had our fingers